content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the January 14th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the A Reporter at Large section. The article is entitled, A Night at the Museum, How a French Cat Burglar Pulled Off the Biggest Art Heist in Decades, by Jake Halpern. Long before the burglar, Véron Tomique, became the talk of Paris, he honed his skills in a graveyard. Père Lachaise, the city's largest cemetery, is a Gothic maze of tombstones in the 20th arrondissement that covers more than 100 acres. Frédéric Chopin, Marcel Proust, and Oscar Wilde are among those buried there. Tomique recalled that in the 1980s, when he was an adolescent, the cemetery attracted hippie tourists who flocked to the grave of Jim Morrison and also drug dealers and gang members. Tomique and his friends found an abandoned warehouse nearby the cemetery, and they began squatting there. Tomique went to school only intermittently, and he and the other boys supported themselves by stealing pieces of glassware from a local factory and then selling them at a flea market by the Porte de Montreux. They also began climbing the high walls on the periphery of the cemetery, which allowed them to break into adjoining apartment buildings. In time, Tomique began robbing apartments in more affluent neighborhoods. His climbing skills continued to improve, and by the age of 16, he could scale the facade of a multi-story building with relative ease. In his letters to me, Tomique described his burglaries in oddly mystical terms, suggesting that his actions were compelled by invisible forces. He used the French word tract, which means toad. He described canvassing neighborhoods before choosing his target. I have to be in harmony with certain places where I feel good, and then at that moment I see, like images from a movie, the places where I have walked in the past week, and some places attract me, and something is waiting for me in the end. As a teenager, he developed a keen interest in drawing, and in his spare time he walked alone through the streets of Paris. One day, when he was 16, he was strolling through the Jardin des Tuileries when he noticed people lining up outside what appeared to be a greenhouse. It was the Musée des Oranges, a structure that was built in 1852 to shelter orange trees and which now houses Impressionist and Post-Impressionist art. Tomique went inside. The museum is best known for its Monet murals of water lilies. But Tomique was enraptured by Renoir's glowing renderings of happy childhoods, kids playing with figurines, practicing the piano, snuggling with mothers. As Tomique saw it, Renoir had used his paintbrush to create a parallel universe, an enchanted version of the grim Parisian life he had known. Renoir was a way of seeing life from a magical realm, Tomique wrote to me. It's as if he even came from this place. It thrilled him to be within a hand's reach of such spellbinding images. One night, he had a vivid dream in which he stole 5 paintings from a museum. He took it as a portent. As he wrote to me, I knew that someday I would be doing something great. Tomique generally worked alone, scaling walls, leaping between rooftops, and picking locks. Once inside an apartment, he looked first for jewelry because it was valuable and easy to sell. A burglary that took less than 2 hours often yielded enough cash to support him for 6 months on the French Riviera. In his letters, he recounted robbing various Parisian luminaries, including the French Caribbean singer Henri Salvador and the Egyptian royal family. He boasted to me that he stole gold buttons and some of Laurence of Arabia's medals from the Egyptians. Tomik often returned to an apartment many times without taking anything, in order to find the most expensive-looking items. He adopted this strategy when robbing the apartment of the designer Philippe Stark in 2004. Stark recently told me, "I never knew anything about my burglar, but I've always had respect for his style, an admiration for his temerity, and a sort of intimate affection for him after I discovered that he'd been practically living with us in the apartment for a few days, spending his time sawing into my poor small safety box without even disturbing us. It was very much a gentleman burglar situation, Arsène Lupin style." Lupin, the quintessential debonair thief, was invented by the French novelist Maurice Leblanc in 1905. Stark went on, "The only shadow that was the only thing he stole was my daughter's jewelry, her only heritage from her deceased mother." Tomik's confidence as a burglar grew to the point that he felt indestructible and invulnerable. Once, while fleeing the police across the rooftops of Paris, he took refuge in an empty apartment in a fashionable building. He decided to take whatever jewelry he could find. Suddenly, the owner came home. "I saw that he was an old man with a very sexy girl," Tomik wrote. "He hid in a closet in the bathroom, adjoining the man's bedroom. I couldn't get out of it without crossing the room," he recalled. "The couple began making love, and that went on all night. He waited until they finally fell asleep, and then made his escape. I have taken many risks like this one, and sometimes much worse ones," Tomik wrote to me, "but I always perform well when faced with these sorts of obstacles." Tomik was exaggerating. His impulsiveness sometimes led him to make poor choices. One day, he ran out of gas while driving through the suburbs of Paris and discovered that he'd left his wallet at home. "I had a toy handgun on me," he recalled, "and so he held up a bakery for 200 francs. He filled his tank, but a witness at the bakery reported his license plate number to the police, and he was arrested. He spent a year in jail." Stark may be excessively romantic in calling Tomik a gentleman burglar. Tomik, who is tall and blunt-featured, with close-cropped dark hair, has been convicted of at least a dozen crimes, among them selling drugs, aggravated robbery, theft with violence, issuing a death threat, and illegal possession of a weapon. A friend of Tomik's described him as brutal and a little wild. At the same time, she said, he had a charming range of passions. He is into aesthetics, classical music, nature, animals, Epicurean pleasures, wine, cheese. He is very out there in his style, even his clothing. Tomik favors G-Star pants, New Balance sneakers, cashmere ski hats, and Lacoste underwear. She said that Tomik was like a poet. Nothing that he talks about the moon. Excuse me. She said that Tomik was like a poet, noting that he talks about the moon. He had maintained his habit of wandering around Paris on foot, modeling himself on Arthur Rimbaud. Above all, Tomik loved fine art. His friend told me that he appreciated Matisse for his joyful and dancing color palette. Klimt for his sensuality, and Renoir for the sweetness that emerges from his portraits of children. She observed, the impressionist art feeds the poetry that is in him. Many of the luxurious apartments that Tomik broke into had valuable paintings, but he tried to resist taking them, knowing that they would be difficult to unload. To sell them was dangerous, and I didn't have reliable sources abroad in order to flog them to collectors or receivers, he told me. Occasionally, though, the allure of the art proved overwhelming, and Tomik took what he found, including, he says, works by Degas and Signac. A decent amount passed through my home, he wrote. He hid some pieces in a cellar, and some stayed with me for a long time on the wall, and it's in these cases that I fell in love. This might sound like braggadocio, but Tomik did make off with some masterpieces. in the fall of 2000. In an episode that subsequently made the papers in France, he used a crossbow with ropes and carabiners to sneak into an apartment while its occupants were asleep, and he stole two Renoirs, a Durand, an Utrillo, and a Braque, and various other works, a haul worth more than €1 million. In May 2010, Tomique was walking near the Seine when he came upon a large Art Deco building. Looking through a window, he noticed a Cubist painting hanging on the wall. Tomique later learned that the building was the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris, known as the MAM, or MAM. But it was the style of the window rather than the Cubist painting that caught Tomique's interest. He glanced up. There were cameras on the roof. Tomique walked up to one of the building's other windows, which was blocked from the security cameras by a parapet. Studying the window's metal frame, he became convinced that it was the same type that years earlier he had disassembled screw by screw in a heist. He took out a pocket knife, chipped away at the paint on the frame, and examined the screws that were embedded in the metal. He could easily break in, he decided. It astounded him that nobody had considered this vulnerability. This made me realize that luck and my past experience were at a rendezvous, he wrote. I even asked myself if I was not in another dimension at the time. A few days later, Tomique went to the MAM as a visitor. It occupies the east wing of the Palais de Tokyo, which was built for the International Exposition of 1937. The museum started amassing its collection in 1953, when the city of Paris donated more than 500 paintings, once owned by a man named Maurice Girardin. Janet Flanner, writing in this magazine, later described Girardin as, quote, an eccentric Paris dentist who had little money, but such a gift for scenting talent among still unappreciated important artists that he had been able, starting in 1913, to buy their paintings at the low prices he could afford. Tomique looked around the galleries with a mixture of pleasure and unease. Certain paintings can provoke me like an emotional shock, he told me. A friend of his compared him to a shaman and added, a work of art emits a vibration, a palpable energy, and Girardin is able to connect to it. When I asked Tomique about this assessment, he agreed, observing, I love to touch antique objects, and I sense a great past of generations and generations that I think are a part of the works. He said that he avoided thinking about art in scholarly terms and noted, sincerely, I have never read a single work about painting or art in my entire life. Inside the museum, Tomique noticed that although the motion detectors were meant to flicker from green to red whenever anyone passed by, several of them appeared to be stuck on green. The discovery delighted Tomique, who has described robbery as ultimately an act of imagination. He wrote to me, I sometimes think for a while, then, as if by magic, but without the magic wand, I had the formula to overcome an obstacle. The typical art thief has no idea who will buy his loot. But by the time Tomique began thinking about robbing the MAM, he had established a steady business relationship with a sponsor, Jean-Michel Corvet, a white-haired man in his 50s who owned several businesses in France, including a healthcare data company and a small gallery in the Bastille neighborhood. Tomique told me that he met Corvet in 2004 through another thief. Our relationship was more than fine, although it wasn't quite a friendship, he wrote to me. We believed in each other, and he wasn't evil, but I later realized that he was dangerous and that he was unable to predict danger. According to Tomique, in the span of several years, he sold Corvez roughly 90,000 euros worth of contraband, including jewelry, gold, and a painting by Johan Jongkind, a Dutch seascape artist. Knowing that Tomique frequently broke into rich people's apartments, Corvez gave him a list of artists favored by his clients, among them Basquiat, Chagall, Klimt, Leger, Modigliani, Monet, Pissarro, and Warhol. Corvez gave Tomik the name L'Araignée, the spider, and urged him to remain in good shape. He often chastised Tomik for eating poorly. Tomik recalled, adding, "Corvez wanted me to work out so that I could climb without any problem whatsoever." Soon after the MAM, Tomik went to see Corvez at his gallery. Corvez reminded him that he would love to have a Laguerre, and one of the paintings at the museum was Laguerre's Still Life with Candlestick, a depiction of a domestic interior from 1922. When the painting had last been on loan to another museum, it had been insured for 4 million euros, and its market price was likely much higher than that. Corvez offered Tomik $40,000.
"I hesitated," Tomik told me, "but my mouth spoke, and then I couldn't help but act."
He spent the next several days making plans for the robbery. On May 14th, 2010, in the early hours of the morning, Tomik walked up to a window that faced an esplanade where skateboarders congregated during the day. At around 3 a.m., he saw a guard briefly patrol the galleries and then walk off. Tomik was carrying a piece of dark cloth, and he hung it like a curtain on the outside of the window to give himself cover. Then he got to work on the window. It took him 6 nights to finish the job. First, he dabbed the window frame with paint-stripping acid, exposing the head of each screw. And then, after applying another solution to eliminate rust, he removed the screws and filled the holes with brown modeling clay that matched the color of the window frame. It was a painstaking process, and Tomik didn't rush. A few hours before dawn on May 20th, Tomik returned to the site in a hooded sweatshirt with two suction cups With two suction cups, he silently pulled out the window. There was a lock holding a grate in place. Using bolt cutters, he broke the lock. He entered the museum briefly, avoiding the few working motion detectors. Then he left and retreated to the banks of the Seine, where he waited for 15 minutes to ensure that he hadn't set off a silent alarm. When Tomik went back inside, he spotted the Laguerre painting, took it off the wall, and maneuvered it out of its frame. He now had an object Corvez prized. But, standing in the museum in the dim light and the silence, he began staring at Matisse's Pastoral. A fauvist canvas from 1905, it depicts three pale nudes resting while a fourth figure, rendered in bronze tones, plays a flute. "I saw a deep, vivid landscape," he recalled, "and the little devil playing his flute out of nowhere, as if by magic, as if he were the guardian of this environment." He took it off the wall. Then he noticed Modigliani's Woman with a Fan, a portrait of the artist's muse and obsession, Lunia Szczesowska. Tomik fixated on the image, which depicted her in a yellow dress, her eyes a cloudy white. "The woman in the picture was worthy of a living being, ready to dance a tango," he wrote to me. "It could have almost been reality." He stole the Modigliani, too. Hill described Tomik's state of mind in the gallery as kind of a mania. The paradox of great paintings is that they are inanimate objects that have lives of their own, he said, and they tend to mesmerize those who look at them. For some viewers, they then take leave of their senses. Tomik, he said, was in some ways little different from the buyer at a Sotheby's auction who gets carried away and ends up bidding 10 times what he intended to pay. Tomik kept moving through the galleries, taking down Pigeon with Peas by Picasso and Olive Tree near Lestac by Braque. He almost stole a sixth, Modigliani's Woman with Blue Eyes, but Tomik recalled, "When I went to get it off the wall, it told me, 'If you take me, you will regret it the rest of your life.' I will never forget what this woman with blue eyes did to me. When I touched it to take it out of its frame, the feeling started instantly, a fear that came over me like an iceberg, a freezing fear that made me run away." It took 2 trips for Tomik to carry the canvases out of the museum. He had parked his Renault a few minutes away from the Avenue de New York. He sat in the driver's seat for 5 minutes. As a professional thief, Tomik knew that it was reckless to linger at a crime scene. But he continued to equivocate about the Medigliani that he hadn't taken. Tomik headed back, but within a minute, reality set in. The streets of Paris were deserted, and he was quite possibly the only person within blocks of a recently burglarized museum. He fled the scene again, though his regret lingered.
"When I drove, the blue-eyed lady was in my head," Tomik told me.
Tomik had planned to meet with Corvez later that morning on the fourth level of an underground parking garage in the Bastille. He spent much of the intervening hours gazing at the paintings in his car, especially the Matisse.
"I had fallen in love," he recalled to me.
When Corvez arrived at the garage in a rented Porsche Cayenne and realized that Tomik had not one, but five stolen paintings, he was more unnerved than pleased.
"He was afraid of me," Tomik recalled.
Nevertheless, Corvez accepted the Leger, as agreed, and also took the Medigliani on consignment. Tomik didn't want to part with the other three paintings and asked Corvez to store them on his behalf, even though he worried about what might happen to the Matisse. He recalled saying to Corvez,
"You could get hit by a car. Whose door will I knock on to recover my goods?"
The mood turned tense.
"We were not far from thinking that all could end badly," Tomik wrote.
By the end of the day, newspapers around the world were reporting on the heist. The stolen works were estimated to be worth more than $70 million, making the theft the biggest of its kind since 1990, when two thieves, disguised as police officers, stole 13 artworks, collectively valued at roughly $500 million, from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. They have yet to be recovered. The mayor of Paris, Bertrand Delanoë, declared, "I want everything to be done to recover these masterpieces." France's elite armed robbery unit, the Brigade de Répression de Banditisme, launched an investigation and soon found a witness, Goran Varasaviek, a skateboarder. He told police that a few days before the robbery, he'd seen a suspicious character on the esplanade outside the museum. A white man, 6'2", weighing about 200 pounds, with a muscular build, an oval face, and a square jaw. He observed, "I really got the impression that he was at work. He was not there to look at the skaters and seemed really to be observing the side of the wall with the windows of the museum." Police records noted that the removed window screws had been laid out neatly in a corner of the museum, underlying the cold-bloodedness of the operation. The five paintings were among the most important in the museum's collection, suggesting to investigators that the thief had a, quote, sophisticated knowledge of the works, end quote, or at least a good eye. After the robbery, Tomik went to meet Corvez at the gallery to collect his payment. Tomik was deeply worried, even paranoid, that police officers were following him.
I knew that a great hunt was going to start," he wrote me.
Corvez gave him a shoebox stuffed with 40,000 euros in small bills. Tomik left and hailed a taxi. He told me that he didn't dare take the metro because he feared the security cameras. As the taxi navigated the twisting streets of Bastille, the radio buzzed with news of the heist. Tomik eventually arrived at the apartment of a woman he trusted. He taped his stash to the underside of a chair. Fearing that he would be discovered at his own apartment, he asked to spend the night. Tomik initially characterized this woman to me as an acquaintance, but in a subsequent letter he explained that she was a sex worker who gave him free passes from time to time. She was not his concubine, he assured me. They were confidants who helped each other out. The woman, an immigrant, had experienced problems with other girls working the same territory, and according to Tomik, had spent time in jail. Tomik had agreed to keep an eye on her as she reclaimed a spot on her old corner on Avenue Foch. One evening, she brought him home, fed him, and let him stay overnight. It became an occasional ritual. Tomik, by his own admission, is not suited to intimacy.
I am a thief. I roam in beautiful neighborhoods. I see what I have to do, but I stay out of people's private lives.
This woman, however, grew close to him, he said, adding, she asked me to do her favors a few times, like to fix her car, to change a tire.
Tomik never fully let his guard down, though. Most of his arrests occurred when someone betrayed him, and Tomik sometimes wondered if she was a police informant.
6 months after the MAM robbery, the police had only a few leads in the case, but they were conducting a separate investigation based on an anonymous tip about a thief and his fence, and the informant provided Tomik's name. On October 1st, 2010, they eavesdropped on a phone conversation in which Tomik ranted,
"The cops! The effing cops think it was me who did the museum, I swear! They're a-holes, it's crazy! They can't understand that the paintings were sold and that they're pissing me off!"
The police compared a photograph of Tomik with the description given by the skateboarder and concluded that they had a likely match. On December 7th, they followed Tomik to the Centre Georges Pompidou, which houses one of the largest modern art museums in Europe, and observed him studying the emergency exits. A day later, they surveilled him as he bought two suction cups, glue, and a pair of construction gloves. In a letter, Tomik told me that he had indeed been intending to rob the Pompidou, but had intuited that the authorities were already on his trail.
"It was definitely a project that needed to wait its turn," he told me.
On December 10th, detectives phoned Tomik, and the call was sent to voicemail. His greeting was astonishingly brazen, as if he were in a manic state.
"If you want to buy paintings or works of art or exceptional jewelry, do not hesitate to contact me," he said. "Among the many paintings, there are five that are extremely expensive."
It's not clear why Tomik wasn't immediately arrested. Charles Hill told me that he found it hard to contain his frustration at the inaction of the French police, which he attributed to smug complacency, a feeling common to those investigating art thefts, that the work will ultimately be recovered. In fact, several experts told me, only about 10% of stolen art ever resurfaces. But Derek Fincham, a professor at South Texas College of Law, who specializes in the illicit trade in cultural property, suggested a potential justification for the delay. The French police might not have wanted to spook Tomik and, quote, inadvertently push the paintings further underground, Fincham explained. A painting that is cut from its frame and rolled up is easy to move. It could be put in a bank vault or buried in a field or even destroyed. Such fears are warranted. In 2001, when the police arrested Stéphane Breitweiser, a French thief who stole 239 works of art from more than 100 museums and galleries, his mother shredded many of the paintings and ground them up in a garbage disposal. On the wiretap, Tomik had promised to get revenge on anyone who followed him too closely. He said, "I'm going to dig up the guns, and on my mother's head, you'll see, the first one who comes near me will get a bullet in his head." As the months passed, Tomik grew increasingly suspicious of Corvez. He tried calling him, but discovered that his number was no longer in service. One day, they ran into each other at the Gare de Lyon. Corvez looked totally white and freaky, Tomik recalled, as if he were going to pass out, and stalled when Tomik asked him about the status of the paintings.
"He gave me no guarantee," Tomik told me. "It was fishy, 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 very fishy."
Tomik surreptitiously taped a subsequent conversation with Corvez in order to have proof of his involvement in the crime. On the recording, Tomik asks him about the Leger, and Corvez tells him that it has already been sold and that the police investigation prevents me from sleeping at night. In fact, As Tomik eventually learned, Corvez still had the Leger. A client had paid him 80,000 euros for it and taken it home. 2 days later, apparently rattled by the media attention surrounding the theft, he returned the painting to Corvez without asking for his money back. Corvez did find a buyer for the Modigliani, Jonathan Bierne, a 33-year-old watchmaker with an art history degree from the Sorbonne. Bierne had a small shop in the Marais. Several months after the theft, Corvez showed Bierne the Modigliani, which he described as extraordinary but of dubious origin. Bierne was delighted by the portrait and eventually agreed to buy it from Corvez. It is unclear if Bierne understood that the Modigliani had been stolen from the MAM, but he handled the painting with great secrecy, persuading the employee at Crédit du Nord Bank to let him place it off the books in a safety deposit vault. Corvez eventually made arrangements to tour the four other paintings at the shop where Bierne sold and repaired his watches, which had a sophisticated alarm system. Bierne and Corvez hid the canvases behind an armoire. Selling the four paintings would not be easy, but Corvez and Bierne seemed to have been aware of at least one promising possibility. Historically, resellers had taken advantage of a legal concept, dating back to medieval England, known as market overt. The idea is that if an object is sold during daylight hours in a venue of open commerce, then its provenance cannot be questioned. The rationale being that if the object had been stolen, its rightful owner could claim it before sundown. Derek Fincham, the law professor, told me that the law is based on the need for market expediency, because courts don't want to be tasked with examining and undoing all these deals. The law remained in effect in England until fairly recently. In 1990, thieves stole two paintings, one by Joshua Reynolds and one by Thomas Gainsborough, from Lincoln's Inn, a barrister's chambers in London. The paintings, worth millions of dollars, turned up at a flea market where they were sold to unsuspecting buyers for the equivalent of a few hundred dollars. Afterward, there was a public outcry, and the Council for the Prevention of Art Theft, a British organization, led a successful effort to abolish market overt. One of the countries that still adhere to the principle of market overt is Israel. I would be very shocked if an Israeli court upheld the purchase of art clearly stolen from a museum, Fincham said. Still, the possibility might have been enough to tempt the buyer to test the court on this matter. In late December 2010, as the French police were closing in on Tomik, Bierne flew to Tel Aviv. He called Corvez. Police officers monitoring Corvez's phone line recorded an exchange suggesting that he and Bierne were arranging a sale. I had the first meeting, Bierne can be heard saying. I believe 99% were going to pass through this. Better than before, Corvez responds. Corvez shared little information with Tomik. At one point, he told him that he'd lined up a Saudi buyer, but later said that the Saudi had backed out and that the solution to their problem lay in Israel. Tomik recalled Corvez saying cryptically, "There's a Russian Jew who's capable of taking the paintings." By the spring of 2011, the French police still hadn't made any arrest. That May, an anonymous source told investigators that Corvez was still in possession of the missing paintings. The source warned that Corvez was interested only in making money and might destroy the paintings if he came under extreme pressure. In conversations with Tomik, Corvez grew increasingly agitated. Tomik recorded one of them, and in it Corvez declared, "I would have preferred that you didn't bring me these things because I don't know what to do with them anymore. I am sick of it." He also said that if anything serious happened to him, a third party would call Tomik and help him recover the paintings. This hardly reassured Tomik, who suspected that the third party was no more than a ghost. Tomik was now in dire need of money. He had been holding on to a small diamond, and he pawned it to Cordovez for 400 euros. The inevitable next step was another robbery. One night, while climbing the facade of an apartment building, Tomik noticed what he thought might be a valuable oil painting near a window. But he couldn't entice Cordovez to commission a theft, so he kept looking for new targets. Another evening, when he was walking down Avenue Montong near the Canadian Embassy, he noticed a stylish duplex in which the lights remained on all night. Tomik suspected that its occupants were away. Using a fire escape, he climbed to the top of a building three addresses down. He crossed from roof to roof and then, with a rope, lowered himself to the illuminated apartment. Once inside, he closed the window to eliminate traffic noise.
"You have to go into listening mode," he explained to me. "It's very important in order to avoid an encounter."
The duplex was quiet. Nobody was home. He searched until he found a collection of watches and several valuable works of art, including a Pissarro. The painting, depicting a man harvesting wheat in a field, was very beautiful, Tomik told me, but he didn't feel any connection to the work. He was more tantalized by a crocodile briefcase with a false bottom and next to it a holster for a gun.
"The holster protected a weapon and the weapon protected the briefcase," Tomik recalled. "One had to think about it. On this playground, a treasure hunt was about to start. But that night, I did not have much time left. I had to come back another time."
Tomik felt certain that great prizes were hidden somewhere in the apartment. He scoured the rooms over and over, but found nothing. He estimated to me that he made 15 clandestine trips to the apartment. On the night of May 12, 2011, he visited the duplex yet again, this time searching an armoire. He noticed an odd-looking gray screw embedded in the woodwork. There was a removable panel. Behind it, he found a safe. He opened it and found only several empty bags. The reported break-ins had been for nothing. That night, he left the apartment with the collection of watches and the Pissarro, which he claims Cordovez had agreed to buy. Police officers had been tracking Tomik's every move. They soon arrested him and raided his apartment, where they found the loot from the duplex and an array of incriminating equipment, including a climbing harness and a grappling hook. During a subsequent interrogation, Tomik confessed not just to the duplex burglary, but also to the MAM heist. There is no public transcript of Tomik's interrogation. His lawyer, David Olivier Kaminsky, who was not present, told me, "As clever as Jérôme is, he couldn't ignore the fact that if he didn't confess, he would have to lie for a very long time and with very great skill." A quick confession, Kaminsky added, could reasonably sound like repentance. Anai Trubilt, the prosecutor in the case, told me that Tomik's confession seemed driven by a different impulse. He is very proud of his work, which he is excellent at, she told me. A court-appointed psychologist came to a similar conclusion, noting that Tomik had described himself as a visionary. Around the same time that the police arrested Tomik, they raided Corvez's gallery and Bjorn's watch shop, but they did not find the five paintings from the MAM. Bjorn later claimed that during the watch shop raid, four of the paintings remained hidden behind the armoire and that the police failed to notice them. The Medigliani, he said, was still in storage at Credit du Nord. According to Bjorn, shortly after the raid, he retrieved the Medigliani and then, in a panic, destroyed all five paintings, leaving their remains in a trash bin outside the watch shop. Bjorn and Cordovez were soon arrested. Desperate to learn more about the painting's fate, Tomik tried to talk with Bjorn, who was being detained at the same facility. But, as Tomik later told a judge, Bjorn did not want any contact with me. Bjorn had even instructed a guard to place a mattress against his cell door, which was made with reinforced glass, so that Tomik couldn't peer inside and see him. Tomik, Cordovez, and Bjorn were tried together. The trial, which was attended by dozens of French journalists, began on January 30, 2017, at the High Court of Paris. Courbet arrived in a black velvet suit, his white hair slicked back. A reporter from Libération wrote that he resembled a Disney villain. Bearn, whom Le Figaro described as, quote, a watchmaker who looks like a student, end quote, seemed embarrassed to be in court. Tomique, the unflappable cat burglar, showed almost no signs of concern. Journalists began referring to Tomique as Spider-Man. Despite the fact that he had stolen art from all of humanity, as a prosecutor put it, the public fell for him. French people are very fond of thieves, stories when there is no blood. Stéphane Durand-Soufflant, who covered the story for Le Figaro, told me, for us, Tomique is a perfect thief because he acted without weapons, did not strike anyone, robbed not an individual, but a poorly supervised museum, fooled the guards without any difficulty, and chose the works he took with taste. Tomique was also polite to the judges. In court, Tomique dropped the pretense of remorse. These paintings are my property. These are my works, he declared. Olivier Bouchata, who covered the trial for the French edition of Vanity Fair, explained to me, by saying this, Tomique was telling us the heist was my masterpiece. I can put my name on it. Tomique boasted about the ease with which he had entered the museum and compared himself to Arsène Lupin. Franck Johan of Le Monde told me that Tomique's story had all the elements of a Lupin story. A spectacular robbery, perfectly organized, without violence, by a sort of artist. Among the French, Johan said, there remains a certain sympathy for those who disrupt the established order. He cited as evidence the rebellions of 1789, 1792, 1830, 1848, 1871, 1936, and 1968. When Courbet spoke in the courtroom, he chose his words carefully. I did not ask him to steal, he said. I told him, if you happen to stumble across a Fernand Léger, I know someone who would be willing to buy it. When Courbet was pressed to identify the buyer, he demurred. It could threaten my safety, he said. Bearn's lawyer said that his client was manipulated into the scheme by Courbet. When Bearn took the stand, he recalled his decision to destroy the art. I am paranoid, and this paranoia is reaching its peak. I lose all discernment, and I decide to get rid of the paintings. I do not know why I do this. I thought I was being followed by the police. I was convinced that I was being filmed or spied on. I thought to myself that I could not leave the building with the paintings, and so I committed the irredeemable. Shaking with sobs, Bearn repeated three times, I put them in the trash. I put them in the trash. I put them in the trash. Many people suspected that Bearn's story was a ruse. He would not have been the first person to invent such a lie. After a Romanian named Radu Dogaru was arrested for helping to steal seven paintings from the Kunsthal in Rotterdam in 2012, his mother claimed to have burned them in her stove. Dogaru subsequently disavowed his mother's claim, saying, the paintings were certainly not destroyed. I don't know where they are, but I believe they have been sold. Even Bearn's wife, a fashion executive, doubted whether he had thrown the paintings into the trash. Courbet shared her view, testifying that Bearn was simply too smart to have done this. Trubilt, the prosecutor, said of Bearn, Courbet, and Tomique, they know very well that the day they get out of prison, the paintings will not have lost value and they will be able to resell them. The judge found all three men guilty. Courbet was given 7 years, Bearn 6. As Bearn was being taken off to jail, he was hysterical, and yet Durand-Soufflant observed, Bearn didn't forget to give his car keys to his lawyer. Bearn did not respond to my request for an interview. Courbet wrote to me, I am not opposed to the idea of an interview on this subject. Nevertheless, I would like to know what would be my interest in this eventuality. Would I be paid, and how much? When I said I couldn't offer money, he stopped communicating with me. Tomik, who was sentenced to 8 years, was far more collected as he left the courtroom. Many observers felt certain that he knew exactly where the paintings were. Frank Johan of Le Mans told me, "Legally, nothing can be done. Even if Tomik knows the truth, it's up to the prosecution to prove that he lied. In France, one has the right to lie at one's trial. There is no offense of perjury." Tomik may be a skilled climber and thief, but the MAM heists required him only to crawl through a ground floor window and then navigate around the few motion detectors that were actually working. Nevertheless, in the press, Tomik's robbery became known as the heist of the century. Charles Hill, the former Scotland Yard detective, is irritated by the descriptions of Tomik's heist as spectacular and perfect. He told me, "Stealing an artwork is actually a rather easy thing to do. In the National Gallery in Washington, the Smithsonian has armed guards, but elsewhere it's mostly just a few older people staring at a wall." Even if Tomik doesn't quite deserve his aura of glamour, his notoriety will likely only add to the art's value if and when it is ever returned. In 1911, a relatively uncelebrated painting by Leonardo da Vinci, the Mona Lisa, was stolen from the Louvre. It took 28 hours before anyone even noticed that it was gone. The painting was missing for 2 years, and during that time, a great many people went looking for it, and the media attention helped turn the Mona Lisa into the most famous painting in the world. I wondered if Tomik might rightly claim credit for a similar alchemy should the MAM paintings resurface. Alain Le Visage, a consultant who specializes in stolen art, told me that this was unlikely. The theft at the Louvre in 1911, one of the most beautiful museums in the world, was like an earthquake, she said. The investigation was aggressive and, for a while, implicated well-known people. The police arrested and then released the poet Guillaume Apollinaire. Pablo Picasso was also interrogated. The story stayed in the papers until the actual culprit, an Italian thief named Vincenzo Perugia, was finally arrested. Nowadays, Le Visage said, robberies of great museums have become commonplace and the news cycle is blindingly fast. Too fast, it seems, for any single image, even one as beautiful as Matisse's Pastoral, to become an enduring icon. Tomik is imprisoned at the Centre de Détention de Val-d'Aurou, northwest of Paris. One of his regular visitors is his girlfriend, Corinne Opiola, a feng shui consultant. During the police investigation, officers referred to the sex worker who let Tomik sleep over as his partner, but this was incorrect. His feeling for her appears to have been more pity than love. "All I know is that she is a very kind person who does not deserve what she does," he wrote to me. His relationship with Opiola is more serious. Tomik, who was released on bail after his arrest, met Opiola in Paris in the months before his trial at a bar across the street from L'Église de la Madeleine. He was reading a magazine about UFOs, and he asked her if he could have a look at it. She was reading a magazine about UFOs, and he asked her if he could have a look at it. "He was not someone who was entertaining me just to pick me up," she recalled. "You felt like he was really present. I felt his authenticity." Later, they communicated on Facebook and spoke on the phone. Opiola had no idea that Tomik was about to go on trial for the greatest art heist in a generation. After his conviction, she began writing to him and later began visiting him in prison. In his letters to her, she told me he often laments the fact that his parents brought him back from Bosnia. Opiola told me, "Each time he writes, they stole my life from me and I would have been a good person. I was obliged to be a thief." Opiola believes that Tomik's current predicament is result not just of his neglectful parents, but also of his fateful visit to the Musée de Lingerie. Tomique, when he loves a work, he wants to possess it, she said. I asked her why he couldn't simply enjoy looking at beautiful paintings. He does not have that distance, she said. It's an uncontrollable impulse. He wants, he takes. Tomique expressed a few regrets. Tomique expressed few regrets to me, though he occasionally made hints about the fate of the stolen paintings. In one letter, he wrote cryptically that, quote, there is no better place for such artworks than where I took them, end quote. He never gave me a sense of where this secret place was or why it was such an ideal home. In his furtive visits to wealthy apartments, he told me he had seen many lovely paintings that he hadn't taken. Because I don't have the apartment or the manner of those rich people who allow themselves to have private collections. He went on, if I had this privilege, I would have acquired a museum by today. I can assure you that. In one of our final exchanges, I asked Tomique again if the paintings had been destroyed. No, he replied, adding, Bien loves the paintings more than anything, and he would have protected them somewhere. Then, as if unable to help himself, Tomique noted, One day or another, he will be forced to give them to the person to whom they belong. That is to say, to me. In the meantime, Tomique spends his days writing letters and trying his hand as an illustrator. He draws images of ceramics and hopes one day to sculpt the designs in a studio in Paris that Opiola owns. His black and white drawings, which are starkly beautiful, depict oval-shaped sugar pots and goblet-like teacups. The images are accompanied by notations with precise measurements, specific colors, and personal observations. He knows that he is not the next Renoir, but he is gratified to be finally making art. I do little sketch drawings, he wrote to me. I don't imagine becoming a great master. And now some poetry. First, Etiology by Maggie Milner. I was born to watch the beavers chewing flood the pond. Fated to bear witness to such confident accretion, my life was bitten down into a point that pointed toward the dome, its whole shorn forest brought to thatch, incredibly, by teeth. There is a seal that spends each morning blunting its incisors on the ice, rasping open breathing holes that close if not routinely shaven back. Until one day its teeth, now dull and domed, stopped breaking through, the animal beating its soft enamel on the ceiling as it drowns. There can be no proceeding from. There is only gnawing through the visible wearing down, the center between living and its damages, until the center's broken door stops granting us admission to our lives. The beavers graft another layer on the dam. They slap their tails so loud a sound like falling dice skitters the smooth, unfrozen surface of the pond, or what had been the pond before it was overflowed, its banks, and drowned the meadow and the campsite and the fire pit we used to turn our spits over, the tusky wooden tapers of our spits. I was born in time to see it swamp. My life a parallel, a cumulative loss of definition. If I am still enough, the beavers will reveal their door, the jam of which they clot into a lodge before my eyes, the underwater hatch through which their chambered penetralia takes shape. My ways, my mammal acumen, are forgeries of theirs. To have been underwater all that time, salient to the outer world, only as a dome, before tearing through the doorway of that world, loud and blue, and sure my life was mine. And now, An American Sonnet for the New Year by Terence Hayes. Things got terribly ugly incredibly quickly. Things got ugly embarrassingly quickly. Actually, things got ugly unbelievably quickly. Honestly, things got ugly seemingly infrequently. Initially, things got ugly ironically, using usually awfully carefully. Things got ugly unsuccessfully. Occasionally, things got ugly mostly painstakingly. Quietly, seemingly, things got ugly beautifully. Infrequently, things got ugly sadly. Especially frequently, unfortunately, things got ugly. Increasingly, obviously, things got ugly suddenly. Embarrassingly, forcefully, things got really ugly. Regularly, truly, quickly, things got really incredibly ugly. Things will get less ugly inevitably, hopefully. And we have time for a few cartoons. First, we see a barbershop. A cat is sitting in the barber's chair, and the barber has his hand on the chair, another hand with a towel. He's looking at the cat, and the cat says, "Just a head scratch today, Carl." In the next cartoon, we see a man sitting at a desk, staring at his computer screen. There are two dogs on the floor. One of them says to the other, "They're bred to stare all day." In the next cartoon, we see two women in a home's kitchen, the dog standing on the floor. One of the women is reaching down into the freezer section of the refrigerator, and she says, "I freeze all my leftovers until I feel less guilty about throwing them away." In the next cartoon, we see two oysters on the floor of the ocean. One of them is wide open and has a pearl sitting on top of it. And the other one says to the one with the pearl, "I guess this makes up for all those months you didn't speak to me." We've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading for you today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.